Guardian Unlimited.
This is Guardian Book Club, and I'm John Mullen, and I'm talking to Andrew O'Hagan about his novel Be Near Me. And I was thinking about doing my little introduction for Andrew and what characterised his books, because I've got his fictional oeuvre here, anyway, in front of me. And if you do, as I do academically, 18th century fiction, you tend to think that the rivalry between Samuel Richardson and Henry Fielding provides the basic template for everything that's happened in fiction ever since. And it usually works. And I have a new little theory that I'm going to test out on Andrew's fiction, which is that Richardson and Fielding presented the basic sort of two ways of writing novels. One is the kind of fiction where you hear the novelist's voice everywhere and all the time, as you might do, say, with a Jane Austen novel. And another, which is, that's Fielding talking to you all the time. And the other is the Richardson model, where writing fiction is all about finding strange other voices who are not yourself. And Andrew's novels, I think, that's the Richardson kind of fiction is what Andrew writes. And it's peculiarly noticeable because if you read lots of Andrew's journalism, as I've done, you can absolutely hear him all the time. But in his novels, you hear all sorts of other people. And as you probably know, the one we're talking about today, Be Near Me, belongs to that rather small class of novels which is narrated by a Roman Catholic priest. I'm sure you'll all be able to name one or two others. I've only ever come across one other, actually. There's a novel by Brian Moore. Called No Other Life, which is narrated by a Roman Catholic priest. But that seems, I don't know, in our kind of times, that seems almost the biggest leap of imagination that a sort of contemporary writer could make, to imagine what it's like to narrate as a man of religion, a celibate man of religion, and his celibacy becomes one of the things that the novel is indirectly about. And I suppose it's an obvious place to start, Andrew, but kind of to start there. I mean, choosing a priest as a narrator, was that a decision in and of itself before the story formed? Because it seems a quite an audacious kind of decision to make.
Yeah, I could very much hear his voice long before I really knew who he was or where he lived. I could hear this quite well-educated, poetry-loving, wine-selecting, slightly annoying man. I recognised something about him immediately, which was that I had never encountered him before, especially in the newspapers. I think that it's interesting what you say, John, about Richardson, because I have always been interested in this business of other voices. I would almost put it down as the thing that distinguishes fiction for me from any other sort of writing, is that each book, each novel, absolutely defines the terms of its own announcement. It can't just be yet another sort of unloading of your narrative voice. There are some very good novelists who nevertheless have a deficiency for me, which is that they carry their style from book to book. They could be writing something in the voice of Bambi or something, you know, about their ex-wife, and they have the same tone, the same pace, the prose is the same. But I've always preferred writers, I think, or at least it's always come naturally to me to admire the kind of writing where the book is a puzzle and it absolutely defines the terms of its own speech, tone, structure. Everything must be in service to the art of the thing. It can't be reported, it can't just be an offcut from something that might appear in The Guardian or something that might have appeared in another novel. It absolutely has to be organically itself. And that's why it takes so long to write them, because I didn't have a posh English education. My priest went to Ampleforth and then to Balliol College, Oxford, and then to the English College at Rome. I did none of those things. I did grow up a Catholic. And certainly in the book, as many of you will know, he encounters, when he goes to that Scottish village, some teenagers who are probably having a childhood quite like the one I had. So in some sense, I was familiar with their territory, although we are 25 years on nearly from being 15 in my case. So things have changed. I had to spend a lot of time going back and listening to the voices of teenagers in the west coast of Scotland. I tend to over-research absolutely everything. I've just been in Los Angeles for 10 days doing the most unspeakably unnecessary things for my next book. We'll talk about that later. But it involved going into the houses of people who were film stars in the 1950s and 60s and really doing nothing but examining the wallpaper. And I feel that novels are made, they have a DNA. A real stylist, in my view, the property that they have is that their books each have distinctive DNA. You could break it down. And I feel that when it came to this, I could hear his voice and I had to pursue what I thought to be the truth of the sound of what he was saying. And eventually Mrs. Poole came in as a sort of contradictory voice to his, and a world then grew around them. The whole thing, I think, animated itself in a vacuum, that vacuum being, in a sense, the moral vacuum that there is around this question of the Catholic Church at the moment, paedophiles, priests, mobs. And I did at one point go back to Scotland where there was a lot of action on a housing estate, a lot of anger, mob anger about a priest. And I went to a mob demonstration outside the priest's house. It was like a carnival. I mean, something that I tried to do for years when I was writing features for The Guardian was to try and offer a picture of what had happened to British community. That the kind of the manners and the business of being a working class person in Britain used to be very different from what it is now. I've come in for a lot of flack from people for trying to point this out as if it's a kind of anti-working class statement, as if I'm turning my back on my own people by pointing out that their culture has actually been deracinated. But I think it has. People in working class communities in Britain had a culture. They had things to do. They had ways of talking. They had work. And something had happened. And it's actually affected, I suppose, the subject of some of the novels, especially in this last one. But to return to the point, outside this priest's house, there was a carnival going on. They all were taking pictures with their mobile phones. You could have sold ice creams. You know, this was, in a sense, the sense of community or being bound together was being bound together with a common spite. Mm. And I felt that that was a moral landscape that hadn't quite got into the newspapers at all. And it would take a novelist or a creative writer of some sort to actually enter into that. And then I saw, just for a brief second, the curtain, the net curtain upstairs flicker. And I suddenly realised that there was a priest behind that curtain and that he had a moral universe, a past, a hinterland, a tradition that he'd either inhabited or departed from, or both. And that's really where novels begin.
There's a priest, isn't there, in your first novel, Our Fathers, who kisses his chosen teenage acolytes, that's a wrong word, but Father David, what he does in Beniermi is actually, he does hardly anything. But yeah. you've taken the risk, as you said, of making him quite, I can't remember what word you used, irritating.
Yeah.
He's quite, because his attitude to his working class parishioners is not quite condescending, but it seems unsympathetic, and he finds it quite easy to think quite easy things about them, quite easily dismissive things. You didn't feel as you were writing it that you needed to kind of squeeze some more sympathy for
Well,
him.
I think there's always a pressure. I really...
And what he does is quite stupid. Yeah, it is quite stupid, isn't
it? He behaves stupidly. He's quite deluded, as people can be in life, especially people very often in a position of power and influence. If there's a really insidious, rather Philistine influence on the novel at the moment, then it's to do with the idea that the central character in all books should be likeable. It was never the case in the 19th century, and I mean, there certainly were plenty of books which had a likeable central character, but you wouldn't really say that Emma Bovary was likeable. It's to some extent quite stupid and self-defeating and romantic in the wrong way, and she brings her own downfall. And
Anna Karenina.
Anna Karenina, and not only women, but I mean, you could easily go through Dickens, some of Dickens' most memorable characters, and see how they defeated themselves. And but there is this attitude at the moment, because bookshops, and I think the culture of bookselling has become so hysterical, there's this notion that people need to have a sort of life-affirming experience when they read a book, which is about loving the central character and wanting to be their best friend. Well, of course, there are times when you do want a book like that in your hand. But very often, if books have an interest in life, then they will, from time to time, be narrated by people who are in hiding from themselves, as I think Father David
is. Yeah, it's not exactly that he's dislikable, is it? Because
I actually like him a lot.
but he's sort of, he's kind of evasive, and he's evasive in this sort of strange private space of the novel.
But there are moments where he absolutely acts against his own interests in a way that is only arrogant. For example, when he encounters the music teacher at the doors of the school, and he starts going on about real music and, you know, talking about Bach and so on. I mean, this is a very run-down area with a very, you know, desperate kind of comprehensive school, and he's exerting his superior wisdom on this harassed teacher. Now, I knew when I was writing that scene where the reader's sympathies would be, and they wouldn't be with the voice of my central character. They would possibly be with this rather, you know, time-serving music teacher with his arm full of violins. But, you know, I trust my readers. I really trust them to, just as they hopefully experience life, with a sense of moral duality, and that they can accept that people can be one thing and another at the same time. You know, even with people you love in your family, you can see that they're both very wonderful and quite terrible at the same time often. And that's fair enough. That's how it should be.
But you trust them. You trust them also, your readers, to discern something not just about character, but about the point of the very way you write, because one of the things, it seems to me, which is sort of, in a way, both the most enjoyable about the book, but also in some ways frustrating about the character, is it's his story. He's narrating in the first person, and he loves sort of nice sentences, and, you know, I just have tried to write about this in one of the columns about the book in the Garden, and he likes to make patterns, seems to me, pleasing and sometimes witty or perceptive patterns, but it's as if he would always prefer an eloquent sentence to a kind of an actual sort of candid self-revelation.
I think he would,
and you depend on your readers to kind of, which is quite a sort of dare, I think, to sort of see that's not, as it were, Andrew O'Hagan trying to write a nice, trying to write a nice book. Mm. It's the narrator using his eloquence, which is all to do with his history and his class and his education, to kind of, to skirt round things about himself.
I mean, I think that's absolutely it. I mean, I read that column on eloquence that you wrote, and I thought it was the first proper the first person I can say this to you, I'm talking to you, the first person who'd encountered that aspect of the book properly, which was to, you know, I didn't want to just write nice sentences. I mean, I can try to write nice sentences as best I can, but that really wasn't the object. The object was to show how this man is. His whole life's about a confrontation between aestheticism and realism. You know, in a book, in a sense, the novel is really about the business of his imagination and his language. In the court, as you mentioned, he knows when he talks that way to the judge that he's talking himself into a sentence. He must do. And I remember when I was writing that part of the book, this is just to give you an illustration of where the material for a novel comes from. It sometimes comes from completely unexpected places. And I realised as I was preparing that day to write part of the scene, and sometimes it becomes quite emotional when you're in the middle of a novel and you know that you're about to, you know, try and...
It's the trial scene today.
It's the trial scene, and it was going to take... I think in the end it took 3 months to write that whole scene, but I knew that day he was actually going to... He was going to estrange himself from everybody this day. And for some reason, I went off and read the transcript of Oscar Wilde in the court and the third trial of the three. where he says things like, when he's asked if he kissed the boy, and he said, no, I wouldn't kiss him, he looked like a doormat or something. And then you can see that everything he's saying is aestheticized, irritating, not doing him any favors, but nevertheless represents a view of life that he has. And I felt that Father David had something of that too, albeit in a very kind of workaday way. He's not Oscar Wilde, he's no great original, but he does have a sense of aesthetic truth that stands at some distance and some remove from the everyday truth that other people are trying to deal with. And if you like, that was one of the subjects of the book from the beginning. And one of the things that probably stands closest to my own life is this sense of having a great interest in reality, but never an interest in reality that isn't attended to by the imagination. Wallace Stevens, the American poet, said, the reality is nothing without the imagination, and vice versa. I think I've always believed that. And I tried to write a novel in which those two things, in a contemporary setting, with a really desperate social conflagration, would come to be investigated, and they're investigated in the language.
It reminds me a bit of The Trial. I mean, you got to The Trial, which is near the end. And of course, there's sort of... I mean, there's a kind of fascinating scenario, I don't know if you had it in mind, which occurs to me now, where somebody, a sort of anti-hero in a way, fails to do and say the things that might have brought mercy or might have got him had an easier time. I mean, there's a, I don't know if you probably read it, there's the hearing in Kurt Sears' Disgrace.
Yes.
Where I think quite comparably the central character refuses to say the sort of things that would have stopped him being disgraced.
And there's
The Outsider.
Disgrace is a wonderful example, because it's a novel, and the reason it's so good, I think, is because in the mind of any sensitive reader, it both sets and then springs a moral trap that only your imagination can actually activate it all. It's that wonderful quote of Ernst Lubitsch that Billy Wilder had printed above his desk, and all his life he looked at it, and it said, the job of the filmmaker, in his case the artist, is to suggest 2 + 2. It's the job of the audience to say 4. And I think what Disgrace does very brilliantly is that it actually provides very subtle materials to you, psychological, social, linguistic, that allow you as a good reader to actually activate a moral drama and then spring the trap and solve in some way. I think when Father David approaches that bridge at the end of the novel, although he's been an enemy to himself, he's been a stranger to himself, he's been irritating, he's actually fulfilled some sort of moral journey. And I think readers don't hate him at the end. Certainly what I've gathered from readers who come back to me and from reviewers in many territories is that they don't hate him. They might feel for him, but he has actually, in a sense, his delusion doesn't damn him. It allows you the opportunity to, in a sense, build an internal life for him that is more sophisticated than the one he has for himself. You know more about his moral landscape than he does, and that's your privilege as a reader. And that's what I wanted.
There's a kind of privilege, I wanted to ask you about the title of the novel, because there's a kind of privilege for the reader in sort of getting the title, because it's a phrase which eventually comes to the character, which he uses in his narration, but two-thirds of the way through the novel. And I was going to ask sort of a Trivial Pursuits question, you know, what does Andrew O'Hagan have in common with Sir Walter Scott, George Eliot and Margaret Atwood, but not Jane Austen, Henry James and J.M. Coetzee? And I mean, there's a group of novelists who always use epigraphs.
Yeah.
And there's a group of novelists who never use epigraphs. I mean, that's one trivial way of grouping them. But I remember asking Margaret Atwood at one of these book clubs about epigraphs, and it was obvious that choosing epigraphs is really important. It's
I think
a really
important
part. And you've gone the whole hog. You've actually got an epigraph, which is a whole poem or a section of a sequence of poems by Tennyson, In Memoriam, which also supplies the title. So it's one of these quotation titles like Far From the Madding Crowd and Brave New World and so on, which kind of, and I always think these are quite risky things because they appear to be telling the reader something that, you know, what the novel's about in a sort of before anything happens. As I read the Tennyson at the beginning,
yeah,
and it was as if your narrator didn't know I'd read the Tennyson, but I had, and I kind of knew that it mattered quite a lot to the book,
yeah,
and that affected, I think, my, and then presumably intentionally affected. And I just wonder why that, yeah, why that mattered to you.
I think those quotes at the beginning are important because if you choose the right one, it's a key to the secret garden. You know, it doesn't tell you what foliage you'll encounter precisely. It doesn't tell you what it will be like to be there or what the weather will be like, but it is a key. It opens the door and suddenly there's all this colour and mystery, and then you disappear into it, you know, and that's the book.
And doesn't it sort of tell you in this novel, doesn't tell you, but it sort of implies, when I read it, and when I first read it, I read any reviews, I don't know, I didn't know completely what, I don't think I knew what was going to happen, I didn't know what thing about David the priest's past was exactly was going to be revealed. And when I read the bit of In Memoriam at the beginning, I did think, well, this book has to be about loss and death, you know, it has to be about mourning.
Mm.
And there's a mention of the person that you eventually find out that the narrator is in mourning for, in a way, or has concealed from himself his mourning for later on, but that reflected my reading, the sense that there must have been a kind of loss which was part of this story.
I like the idea that there was that, because rather like in listening to an orchestral piece, I quite like the fact that there is an overture, there is a sense in which all the themes and resonances are sort of presented to you in a pattern. Then, of course, the extrapolation of them will be the piece. I've noticed, for instance, that, I mean, we could easily discuss in similar terms the use of prologues.
Yeah, well, I did want to ask you why.
Quite a number of my books have prologues.
Yeah.
I think all of them, in fact. Yeah. And it's to do with this same sense of wanting to give the reader a whole sense of, you know, to actually suck them into the funnel and let them sort of see that. I don't mind if they, as you say, you suddenly realise there's going to be love and loss. Yes, that's fine. I mean, many 18th and 19th century novels, as you know, used to give you a synopsis of the chapter at the head of the chapter. So, I mean, not everything about reading novels is about the excitement of finding out what happens next. None of my books are really exciting on the level of what happens next. I know that. It's never been what I tried to do. In fact, I should probably instruct my publishers not to give away so much, even though they're not really about the intricacies and the excitements of plot. If you like, the moral drama that exists in a book, which is much less sequential, you know, I always like Scott Fitzgerald growing up, and you don't read Scott Fitzgerald because you're thrilled with what happens next. I mean, you read, in a sense, the meditation in those novels collects and pools. You know, it's not like a river running madly forward. And I think I like that. I like the idea that the reader begins to connect up the various, you know, pools of consideration. So giving a clue at the beginning, even a heavy clue like that, did seem appropriate to me. Also, I came very late to that title and to that,
right,
that quote. The book wasn't called Be Near Me until very late. I had to work to find that title, and I finally found it in the poem and the, of course, the...
But what about the prologue thing? Because that is a... Because you could draw up a little list of novelists who always use prologues.
Yeah.
You know, Donna Tartt, lots of detective novelists always use a prologue. And there's two kinds of prologue. There's the ones where you get the prologue and then you go backwards, because the prologue is actually something that has happened recently in the story.
I would argue that Be Near Me's prologue has absolutely everything. Every theme that's in the book is in that three pages. Absolutely every one of them. I don't award myself any points for that. It's just, it came very naturally. It's a way of stylistically, you know, getting your reader and saying, I have something to tell you, and I'm going to tell you in this way, like this. And like that opening to The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, just absolutely, you know, getting somebody by the lapels and giving them a kind of condensed feel for the book before you lead them in.
It also has the peculiar effect and the sort of rather both haunting, slightly discomforting effect in Be Near Me, that in the prologue he is in his 20s and he's about to become a priest. Mm. And then the story starts and covers actually quite a concentrated period, 29 years later. Mm. And it's part of, I mean, something that interested me about it, and I don't know how deliberated this was, which is a sort of what sort of makes him a priest and what the business of carrying out his spiritual duties, which we presume quite a lot of the time from things we know he does or he has done, you know, and his housekeeper says to him, you know, oh, you used to visit the old people and you used to do this and you used to do that. But in the 29-year gap, he's gone and been a priest in Lancashire and he's gone through youth and middle age. And that's erased, you know, not erased, that's just left out.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's left out sort of is quite a kind of shadows the rest of it.
Yeah.
As if that bit of, I mean, this is to say too much, I'm sure, but it's as if that bit of the story almost doesn't matter. It's not what...
Well, in a sense, you can sometimes, as in, you see that, I'm trying to write a play at the moment, and you see how much play writing is really about this, about the leaving out of really vast numbers of things. It seems to me that it's much more powerful, his experience before he comes back to Scotland, much more powerful by not being described. That actually there's this long period of boredom, and he's not a very good priest, obviously. He's not interesting as a priest so much as he's interesting as a human being. And actually the war between the two duties might be seen to be the subject of the book. But those 30 years he spent in Blackpool, I'm absolutely certain that the reader by the end of the book can imagine just exactly what they were like. They don't need my help. And that's what I meant when I said about activating a moral drama in the mind of the reader. There are whole things that you think and journeys you'll make into the psychology of that man which have got nothing to do with me. They're just to do with how he sits in your imagination. In that period of 30 years, you'll each imagine differently, just as you'll imagine his appearance differently. I mean, there's something that Jane Austen teaches writers very well, and it's to not go into that much detail about what people look like or what they're wearing, because the reader will do that anyway. You know, it's completely unnecessary.
In 2 weeks' time, I've got to give the annual talk to the Jane Austen Society, and it's supposed to be about what people look like in Jane Austen's fiction.
Well, it's interesting. if you look at the opening of Persuasion, suddenly characters are brought on. You don't really have any description of their physical attributes. Sometimes somebody will be plain or, you know, pretty, but you won't get, they have a blue bonnet and emerald eyes, and, you know, George Eliot would get 14 pages out of that. But I feel that whole chunk of his life is really the reader's business. They can populate that with corkscrews and gardening and paperbacks, and I do give them some clues, but
you don't need that much. You say he's not a very good priest, and I did think that sort of... I did think that, and one of the things that made me think that was, I mean, which is brilliant, they're brilliant little passages with him and Mrs. Poole when she is diagnosed, she gets this awful letter which tells her that she's got cancer, and his, well, partly his sort of, the things he says to her, because, I mean, my sort of, my observation of priests is that not all of them, but some of them, simply out of occupational, perhaps just they get practiced in these things that most of us aren't practiced in, do become quite practiced at sort of dealing with people who, you know, are facing, death and illness and so on. And he's hopeless, isn't he? And he's not just hopeless, but he's also, there's this, when she gives him the letter because the letter's been sent to his house because she doesn't want her husband to see it. And when she, it's not just the things he sort of, as it were, fails to say to her, but it's even the things he sort of fails to think.
Yeah.
You know, so he starts thinking about, what was it, she had breast cancer and something in her kidney. She spoke of an operation, of convalescence and time off work. The way she spoke brought to mind an instant panorama of snow-topped chalets and sanatoria. I thought of a bald-headed Nijinsky practicing his famous entrechat in the Alpine evening. No, I mean, it's... But, I mean,
he is quite terrible sometimes.
You know.
Well, I mean, I was intrigued by the extent to which he... Somebody who could have such deep feelings about themselves, because there's such shallow feelings about other people. And again, that doesn't damn him either. There is no damning.
No.
There's only what people are like. And I remember when I was a kid, the priest used to come round to the house and they were all incredibly thick. And I was really motivated by this, the thickness of the parish priest. And my mother used to smack me around the head for saying this, how thick they were. There was one in particular, Father McLaughlin, who was so thick that it was unbelievable. And of course, socially the roles were completely reversed, because I was the working class kid living in a housing estate and the priest was coming in, but I was reading Virginia Woolf and thinking he was thick. And so actually the books are sort of revenge on the whole social circumstances. I see that when I look back that I was amazed that these priests could, I mean, everything they did by rote in that particular period, at that particular time. These were Irish priests in the west coast of Scotland, and they were very bigoted, and they loved Celtic. They didn't care about anything else, and they never read a book in their lives. And they used to haunt the housing estate. They'd come in with those little bags that you were supposed to put money in, and all the families were struggling in those days. And I developed a real dislike for them. I thought they were morally empty. I remember telling my father that once, and he looked at me and said, "You're a Protestant." A Protestant, a writer, you know, he knew it was going to be something extreme. But I think that's it. You know, I remember when I first met my girlfriend, India Knight, who had a very different kind of Catholicism in her childhood. That's to say, she knew a lot of quite intelligent priests. And I remember saying to her one night, "The difference between your experience of religion and mine is that all the priests that I encountered were really stupid, and all the ones that you encountered really loved wine and poetry, and, you know, they loved going to the National Theatre." And finally, when I was researching this book, I did encounter a priest like that, and I got enormously close to him. I was always taking him out. I was always taking him to Rules, that restaurant up the road. Not because Rules is especially posh, but it just looks posh when you're in there. It's very red. And he was too unsubtle to... I mean, if you'd taken him to the Wools or something, he would have liked that well enough, but Rules was right for him because it was just targeted right to the heart of his prejudices. He was a snob, most amazing sort. And he would say things like, of course, when it came to ordering, I took he and the Bishop of Paisley. Well, is this being recorded? Sorry. Anyway, he and an unnamed bishop to lunch, and they started off by saying, of course, they didn't know anything about novelists. I mean, they read and things, but they didn't understand how we notice absolutely everything. So I'd taken them to lunch to watch them, basically. And the first thing I was able to watch was them saying, of course, it's Lent and we really don't drink or eat much at all. We'll have another bottle of claret, thank you. And so this claret sodden pear, you know, fell out of the restaurant. It was great. And it was my encounter finally with priests who were like that, as opposed to the ones in my childhood. And I think that Father David has something of that, you know. I mean, he organises that supper party.
Yeah.
He must know that the people he's invited to this supper party will only be puzzled and threatened by his fish stew with matching white wine, you know. So he goes and he knows that these particular wines from these particular vineyards will complement this this fish stew. And it's a tremendous wind-up. He must know that. And at some level he does, but at another level it's important to him as a matter of self-definition that he shows these guys that he's himself.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, there's a that sort of, I don't know, that kind of hint of sort of Epicureanism about him.
Yeah.
Which is then substantiated when you go back and find out eventually about his past, and he's kind of part of this slightly kind of, I know you won't thank me for saying this, but Brideshead-y sort of set, and Brideshead does get mentioned, I think.
Yeah, that was the thing about them, that they're not even original aesthetes, they're kind of copying Brideshead.
I was just thinking that that touches also on something quite sort of, must have been something quite sort of hard for you at the heart of the book, which is his relationship with, and this is the last thing I want to ask you about before I give other people a chance, his relationship with these two 15-year-olds, Mark and Lisa. And in his burnished prose, he seems, particularly with the boy, he seems to burnish him. Mm. And yet these kids, although Mark is kind of, he's sort of marginally amusing in that, you know, he says some quite iconoclastic things, but the sense that the central sort of, that central relationship might be based on a kind of, you know, sort of aestheticized self-delusion. You must have felt that was quite a kind of risky thing when you were writing it. That
I have to say to you, I felt almost it was a matter of social realism. That's the way I've always imagined life, that it is, to some extent, a battle royal between what people imagine and what people experience as being real. That these two things are constantly relating to each other in ways sometimes beautiful and sometimes tragic. It's at the heart of all the writers that ever mattered to me. It's at the heart of Shakespeare. It's at the heart of F. Scott Fitzgerald. All the poetry that I grew up loving. Of course, they have many features and styles, and they're about other things too. But essentially, that central drama between Father David, a man who's sort of almost, he's invented a beautiful world to hide in. And although he encounters these two 15-year-olds who seem to be lacking all the totemic aspects that would matter to him in terms of knowledge and beauty and experience and depth, they have some other vitality which is beyond speech for him. And it's one of the sadnesses of life and of loneliness and of growing old, is to know that you can't simply aestheticize reality. But then again, being in their company, even when he's there with them, he knows that it's this wonderful moment in Tam O'Shanter where Robert Burns describes snow falling in the river, a moment there, then gone forever, he says. And that's, in a sense, what he's experiencing all the time. The snow is real, and so is its disappearance. And he's tangled up in the great sense that all his life has been like that. Things that are real and true and beautiful come into contact with him and then disappear. And he's trying to survive their disappearance, as we all do. And the drama really at the centre of his life is that he's devoted himself too much to that kind of hankering, to that kind of devotional, almost pseudo-religious. Mm. He's not good at being a priest, but he's good at thinking in a pseudo-religious way about his own life. You know, he's always raising his spirits to some level where they can hardly breathe, at a level above the clouds where, you know, his sentences can just about breathe. He's gone too far in his idealization of his own life, and then he finds himself in a town like that and in a court like that, where though there are many imaginative feats that exist in those places, people don't generally live that high in the ether. And I felt anyway that by the end of it, although he hasn't really resolved all the things in his life, he's learned how to breathe slightly more naturally.
For the first time I met Andy, I think, it was when I heard him read Tam O'Shanter. So,
oh, yeah.
Which he does very brilliantly. But so I'm glad it's come back again. Would anybody here like to ask, please?
You started this very stimulating discussion with reference to the rarity of a novel about features a Catholic priest. And I wonder if I could ask you to put together your central character and your own background of a Celtic and Rangers kind of nature, and your role as a novelist, as a godlike figure. You know, your prologues sound rather like, I haven't read the novel, I've just read the column in The Guardian. You sound like Sophocles or Euripides. You know, you introduce in a godlike way the situation of your characters, and then you show the terrible things that happen to them.
Yeah.
So putting those things together, what is the role of God in your novel?
Well, it's interesting because I think you've answered the question by asking it. The great sort of, you know, boundless egotism that it takes to invent characters, do away with some of them, preserve some of them, and teach all the rest a lesson is everywhere evident when you come to write a novel. The Euripidean sense of controlling lives is very much, in any decent novel, what you're really doing is laying out the possibilities of how the reader can do that and be God. Because I think it's really you, readers, who fully animate these people and really complete them as moral beings. As far as it goes, I would feel, I mean, God's quite a disappointment to me in many respects anyway, but in this book, I mean, I probably found myself drifting further and further from my sense of his beneficence as I wrote this book, because I felt really that when organized religion cranks into this novel, it always comes in with a very sort of ridiculous expression in its face. For example, the bishop, I think, is one of the really stupid people in the book. He represents that part of the Catholic Church which is quite reckless in its sense of self-protection.
But he's done something quite, as it were, stupid and important in the book, which is he sort of fixed up the narrator's job, hasn't he?
Yeah, Bishop Gerard is really one of those people. He would be an example of the kind of priest that I grew up with, who really knows, and I choose my words carefully, but he knows absolutely fuck all about human nature. I mean, nothing about human nature. If he knew anything about human nature, he would never have put that Father David into that parish. It's almost an act of vengeance. As he says at one point, Father David himself says, you know, as if to test the locals' affection for fresh-cut lilacs or something, you know, he knows that he's, in a sense, playing God by introducing this aesthete into the situation where there is only struggle over people's sense of self. You know, there's a struggle about poverty and identity, and yet he sends them in there. And then when the inevitable happens, and I think it is inevitable, when it happens, he does that terrible thing which bishops up and down this country have been doing for years, of trying to suggest that the church will cover for him. You know, incidentally, I mean, I believe that one of the ways in which novels, good novels, I hope, earn their keep, is to do something that the news never does. Even in good newspapers, there's a kind of incredible dedication to the business of black and white. Things are either very good or very bad. And novelists live in that grey area between black and white. And if you want to sort of live a moral life, I would argue that what you want to do is occasionally read novels. Because if you were to just follow the newspaper coverage on issues such as those that come up, even peripherally, in a peripheral way in this novel, then you would just never have anything but a stock of well-rehearsed prejudices in your mind.
If I go back to our village, I have almost the same set of character, this priest that that knows, although I don't know nothing about his real his own past, but a lot of those patterns really look through the way he speaks, or he talks about wine or different things, where you see he has come to this artificial world. And I think you put it very nicely when you said, well, nicely, you put it to the point when you said what they're lacking is really the sense of family or the sense of partnership or whatever you have, but the sense of contact to another human being.
I think about that pattern, I think it's a mistake when I teach creative writing, when I have students, I always try and encourage them not to, although it's a novel many of them are writing, that getting into the business of novelty, you know, is a mistake, where you try always to find sort of something sort of excitingly fresh to say about the way people live in communities in Britain. The way people live in communities in Britain is a completely under-described thing. I mean, there's too few novels that actually handle it, in my view. So the idea of saying, oh, you know what, there's enough soap operas, I'm just going to make everybody a kind of lizard, or I'm going to turn everybody into a sort of space object. You know, there's terrible sort of need for novelty and freshness at that level, when what we really need is, I think, for novelists to tie up their shoelaces and get out of the house and go and look at Britain and see what it's like, and occasionally not just Britain but the world, and come back with fresh embodiments in literary terms of what's there and what could be there and what is there behind what is obvious. I think that's important.
So perhaps there should be more provincial novels, because
I really wish.
We run a UCL and undergraduate course called London in Literature, and I had to teach them contemporary fiction element of it this year, and I sort of realised that almost every, you know, interesting, good literary novel for the last 10 years, I exaggerate, but I mean, London, it was almost all in London, you know, but actually it was much harder to find one which had a palpable location that wasn't London for at least quite a lot of the time.
I think it's so important. I mean, we do live in quite a small series of islands here, but there are whole ways of life. You think of women's lives in Scotland, just to tread on familiar territory. Women's lives in Scotland are fantastically underrepresented in the novel. Of course there are novelists who deal with it, that we have women characters in our books, but the whole experience of that's a very masculinist culture up there. And what has it been like for women to grow through that? I just think that we haven't really even begun. You know, that's why when I read those pieces saying, oh, the English novel is dead, or the British novel's over, everything's been done, hardly anything's been done. Or at least hardly anything's being approached with the seriousness and dedication that it was approached quite regularly 120 years ago. There's millions to be done, including, of course, that other great strata, which is British writers writing about life outside of Britain, which I think there's a great tradition of that, and we haven't, I mean, we need to keep that going, which is why my next book is set in America.
Well, as you can probably hear, Andrew's voice, which was actually non-existent this morning when I talked to him on the phone.
Yeah.
I mean, he did some emergency therapy.
Yeah.
But I think it might be about to go again.
Absolutely.
Andrew. So maybe it's time just to thank him very much for coming to speak to us. And
thank you.
He'll sign some books if anybody would like their books.
Guardian Unlimited.